This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Good evening, everyone. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak radio show. Here, when the people speak, they make a difference. Our guest tonight, Helena Norberg Hodge, is one of those people who has made an incredible difference. She is the only Westerner to speak the language of the Ladakh, a people who lived in a once Shangri-La-like village in the Himalayas. And Helena Norberg Hodge's introduction to the devastating effects of globalism on economies and environment came through knowing these people and living in that region. During Helena's recent tour across the U.S. and Canada, she has been speaking about her book and film, the documentary, The Economics of Happiness, which proposes a solution to globalism. That solution is, she calls, localism, a topic we here in the People Speak have covered quite in depth with guests from my own state of Michigan, guests who have talked about local community business, such as Mary Ann Demo, who runs Three Farmers Markets, Tanya Allen, a local entrepreneur. And Helena, first of all, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Yeah.
And before I do get started, I would like to put out to any person that has or has been affected, anybody that has not been affected is an interesting person in and of themselves, with the unfathomable devastation in Japan. So our thoughts go out to the people of that nation, and it's just unfathomable. And I know I speak for you too, Helena, when I say this.
Absolutely, and I've just come from Japan just a few weeks ago and have many friends there. In fact, we have an Ancient Futures Network there with 1,000 members who have been introducing localization there. And I love the Japanese people, and I find it very impressive how calm and composed and cooperative they remained. That's very, very impressive in this terrible situation.
It is indeed, and I find that often happens in places where the West seems to accuse people of not being as civilized as we are here, and yet the claim always fails because these people always react with the utmost grace, the utmost love, the utmost honor towards each other, and with the utmost compassion. So, yes, I agree with you. They have held themselves up. So little looting has happened, so little. It's just an amazing, amazing thing to watch in light
Absolutely.
Of all the devastation.
Yes.
Helena, can you tell us something about your childhood in Ladakh and how it has shaped your life's work?
Well, it wasn't my childhood. I went out to Ladakh, which is actually quite a big region. There are hundreds of villages. It's the westernmost part of Tibet, up on the Tibetan Plateau, and a part of Tibet that belonged politically to India. And it was sealed off for political reasons, so no one was allowed to go there from the 40s to the 70s. And I came out just as it had opened up, and I was actually, I think I was 29 at that point. And I was a linguist. I came originally with a film team. I was only going to stay 6 weeks. But I was so fascinated by the people and also by the language, so I decided to stay on and to work on the language. And I came across people who were more happy and more sort of vitally happy than any people I had ever encountered. And I had traveled quite a lot and spoke quite a lot of languages. But here it was just this amazing joy and vitality. And learning to speak the language fluently, I then got an insight into how the global economy fuels insecurity and how it actually destroys the self-esteem and the community fabric that I have become convinced is a necessary prerequisite for health and happiness. So in Ladakh, I came to realize over the years, as the change came in, as the outside economy came flooding in, that part of what happened was that unemployment was created, something that had never existed for thousands of years. And with the unemployment came it was a consequence also of urbanization, because the global economy is systematically destroying small-scale agriculture that is providing for local needs and regional needs. So worldwide, small farmers are being destroyed. And as they are, you know, they're being pulled into big cities, which are running on fossil fuels, and in those big cities, they are now completely dependent on money and jobs. And those jobs, almost within, literally within just a couple of years, there was serious problems of unemployment and intense competition among the young people who had been brought into the city hoping to get jobs, and that led to local violence between different groups, different ethnic and religious groups. But also, very importantly, what I had a bird's eye view of was that these people who had been the happiest I had ever encountered, suddenly young people in particular started developing a sense that everything about their culture, their language, their food, their clothing, their housing, everything was inferior to what they saw in the media and advertising, which was fundamentally a westernized consumer culture. And suddenly, it wasn't that long before young Ladakhis were telling me that it was better to have lighter skin and to be taller and have a bigger nose and, you know, Western-style eyes. And it was very, very clear there that these problems had not existed before, and that this sort of self-consciousness of trying to adapt to outside role models, you know, was just not part of their culture at all. So you just didn't have illnesses like bulimia and anorexia and these problems that we have in the West. It took me a while to realize that the same thing is essentially happening in the West, which is why, you know, young girls will decide they're not thin enough and often decide to starve themselves, and why young people now at an earlier and earlier age are asking for plastic surgery and that kind of thing. So I think I got this microcosm of how the economic system is a driver of friction between people, because it's creating such tremendous insecurity economically, but also, very importantly, the psychological dimension. So that's basically what then became for me a lens through which to study the impact of the economy in other parts of the world. And I had written a book based on that called Ancient Futures, and we made a film based on that too. And that's, they've been translated into about 50 languages. So we've had contact with, you know, hundreds and hundreds of groups around the world. And they're all saying, well, the same thing is happening here. And that's what this film, The Economics of Happiness, is about. Because that, you know, it's called The Economics of Happiness because we're showing very clearly that where you have stronger community ties at the local level and where you have a deeper contact with your place, which also means the natural world, that leads to human well-being and happiness. And so we're showing how the localization movement is demonstrating many of these benefits.
Well, but let me ask you, yeah. Helena, it goes even deeper than that, and you have to see, and for those of you that have not heard of the film, you definitely have. This is a must-see. And it showed me that the true insanity behind, and it really isn't very complex, it's as if you had two opposing forces at work here. You have, one of the things that I found extremely interesting was in one part of the film, you had different products that were being exported, imported together in a trade basis from different companies, countries. And one of them, I think, was Argentina, where we had I think it was like 3 billion tons of potatoes a year, that were exported into our country. And we exported into their country about the same amount of potatoes. So, and I thought to myself, we should just keep our own potatoes. And we would do a lot better. And, you know, one of the other things was that, like, the United Kingdom transporting and exporting fruits like such as apples to be washed and waxed in South Africa and returned to the United Kingdom. I mean, that kind of insanity. How did we become so convinced that insanity was the way to go?
Well, I think for one thing, you know, most people still don't know that this is going on, that this incredible, insane trade is going on of literally importing and exporting bottles of water, milk, you know, things that need refrigeration, butter. And I also mentioned in the film, you know, I did a study about butter around the world, and I found that literally everywhere I went, butter from hundreds and thousands of miles away cost much less than local butter. So what we have is a system that has really created so-called growth essentially by supporting the big traders. You know, if tomorrow around the world people would sit down for breakfast and eat only food from the region, no multinational would make money, but instead literally millions of smaller farmers and businesses would make money. So we do, you know, the main reason why we got to this insanity is that we've blindly supported multinationals. And that's what governments have been doing.
And deregulation
often, I mean,
of government.
The sad thing is that the governments believe that supporting their multinationals is in the national interest. There's still the perception, you know, that giant businesses provide more jobs. And the fact is that many smaller businesses provide more jobs than one giant business. But they, and they, also the tragedy is that when, as governments are supporting their multinationals, they're actually making government poorer vis-a-vis these giant for-profit entities. So, so governments are now going with their begging bowl to big business and saying, you know, will you please do a partnership? You know, they call it PPP, public-private partnerships, to build up infrastructure. You know, now more and more hospitals are being built, you know, through private funding and becoming privatized. And we need to distinguish between privatizing downwards to smaller, accountable, located, localized businesses and banks versus into the hands of mobile multinationals, which are completely linked and driven by the blind speculation that we got a little bit of an insight into how that works, you know, during the global financial crisis.
And one of the things, what do you, what are your thoughts on the Supreme Court of the United States approving the that corporations can fund campaigns?
Well,
I just was totally
just
blown away
giant.
By that.
You know, we should be going in exactly the opposite direction. And,
exactly.
And, you know, the tragedy when you look around the world right now is that governments everywhere are caving in to the power of the global finance and corporate lobbies. And I think, you know, I do think this is the single most important issue for us to wake up to. And so we're hoping with the film that people, if people can see that the same policies that support giant businesses are the policies that are responsible for job insecurity and a widening gap between rich and poor, you know, there isn't a single country right now that, any, that I know of where the gap between rich and poor isn't widening in an absolutely obscene way. And that includes Scandinavia. I mean, it's literally everywhere. So that, if people could just see that the same policies that create unemployment and poverty are the same policies that are also a disaster environmentally, driving up CO2 emissions, creating toxic waste, so that we could get a linked-up movement between the environmentalists and the social activists to demand economic policy change. Now, what we are also showing in the film is that people are beginning to take action into their own hands at the local level, and they're demonstrating how much better it works when businesses are more localized and of a more human scale when you have more of a direct relationship between farmers and consumers, between farmers and shops and restaurants, you're cutting out the middlemen who are just bleeding us dry. You know, when you shop in the supermarket, very often, out of every dollar, only 10 cents will go to the farmer. Whereas when you shop in a local shop or farmer's market, you know, 80 or even 100% can go to the farmer, and you're really paying for what you want, which is fresh, healthy food.
It is amazing when we talk about these things, and I absolutely 100% wholeheartedly believe in localization. This issue of local markets, urban gardening, collaborative efforts within communities to come together and help to sustain each other. I mean, look at America today. We are absolutely no longer a manufacturing base. I know people want to believe that we are, but there's no way on earth that we can possibly compete with 50 cents an hour wages. So what do we have here? We have a society that is exporting whatever we do have, and the rest, people are falling off the grid in unbelievable numbers, and they are now coming together. Entrepreneurial businesses have flourished. Again, local community chambers of commerce are starting to attract more people. We have to come together in order to be able to sustain ourselves through this.
Absolutely, and if people could just understand how dramatically we reduce the waste in resources if we localize. You know, there's no reason at all why America couldn't provide for all the needs of the people. People often believe that we need multinationals even to have a telephone or an airplane. Absolutely not true. The multinationals have ended up so independent and so free. You know, they're not paying taxes the way rooted businesses do. And they are basically now, in effect, we have corporate rule instead of rule by government. Now, another thing I want to say is I've been asked to write about this, and I haven't had a chance yet, but you know, when you look at the uprisings in Egypt and, I mean, literally worldwide, what we're seeing is enormous dissatisfaction with government. In the Middle East, it's with dictators. But in Australia, you know, for a while, it looked like it wasn't even going to be possible to form a government. Belgium recently spent, I don't know how many months, I think it was, before they could try to get some kind of coalition together. The UK has this weird coalition. And in other countries, there's this swing back and forth from left to right. People worldwide are really angry and dissatisfied with their governments. And I believe that the absolutely essential thing is greater economic literacy, that we understand better why governments are now too poor to provide for us, that we understand why we have unemployment. Unemployment has nothing to do with overpopulation. I think people sort of believe that. They think, it's harder for my child than it was for me, and it's because it's a more crowded planet. With more people, we have more work. And especially because we're now so crowded, we need to care for the water and the trees and for the real economy, you know, with much greater care. So there's even more work to be done. But instead, what we have are policies that encourage big business to employ energy and technology at every turn, replacing people either with energy and technology, so they create pollution and unemployment simultaneously, or they're being encouraged to go flying across the world in the search of the cheapest labor. And you probably know that already, you know, maquiladoras in Mexico were abandoned for people in China. Now there's a shift from China to Vietnam for many of these functions. And we're basically reaching the end of this ridiculous search for, you know, allowing a giant business to employ people who can survive, you know, on $1 a day for production. They're employing people to produce, you know, earning like, you know, well, it's probably a bit more than $1 a day now, but it's, you know, absolutely minuscule. And then selling in countries where people, you know, need $100 a day. That's an ideal situation for big business, but it's a terrible situation for the people of this world and for the environment.
What part has the media played in the sale and promotion of globalization, Helena?
Well, what part has the media played in promoting it?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, huge. It's very, very sad. I'm sort of amazed by the way in which the media has ended up essentially supporting, you know, a corporate view of the world. You know, that now also includes undermining localism and localization. There's a study after study which gets reported in the media, which says that, oh, no, you know, buying food closer to home doesn't really reduce CO2 emissions. and also, you know, including things like saying in the UK, oh, no, it makes sense to fly shrimp to Thailand to be peeled and then fly them back again. Because if we kept the shrimp in England, we'd use machines. But in Thailand, they're peeled by hand. So there are all these bogus.
So we've convinced ourselves. We convince ourselves that by doing this, that we have put these poor people to work.
That's true too. And again, you know, I think it is important that we realize it's not so much us convincing ourselves as big business convincing us. And the way that works, you know, I don't think it's a sort of conscious conspiracy. I think a lot of the people employed in big business who promote these ideas, they often believe them. They particularly this idea that this helps poor people in the third world, and more fundamentalists, you know, that whether you're a CEO of a big company or a president of a country, the idea is that growth is essential. It's your responsibility to keep the economy growing. And the fact that that growth, you know, thrives on breakdown, you know, the truth is that if we wanted GDP to go up in America, one of the best things would be if everyone got long-term serious illnesses that would require drugs, surgery, all these activities that would involve an exchange of money would mean that the GDP would go up. If they stayed healthy, the GDP would go down. You know, so it's insane. I mean, and the same thing with, if the water is so polluted, we have to buy it in bottles. That's good for GDP. We really need to get some basic economic literacy out there so that people start shaking their heads and demanding a change in economic policy. If they can realize that their job and financial insecurity, as I say, is structurally and really, I was going to say directly, but it's systemically linked to global warming and to so many of the very serious environmental problems we have, I think we can have a very powerful movement. And I do believe that the major problem is blindness. So as I said, even in government and business, these people stick to the idea that growth is necessary, and they put out this idea that it's like the economy is like a bicycle. If it stops, you fall over. So you've got to keep growing. That's all complete baloney. You know, we could practically to do what needs to be done to change subsidies and taxes to support lower carbon, more localized, more nature-based business would actually require less money than to keep this very toxic, long-distance, giant business path going. You know, whether we're trading in toxic debt or toxic waste, this is a function of economic policy. It's got nothing to do with the need to keep the economy going for, you know, for anything but for big business.
Helena, you speak in during the course of the movie, there was a reference to a Genuine Progress Index. Can you tell our listeners what the Genuine Progress Index would help people to understand?
Well, the most important thing about this movement, which has, there are a number of efforts to look at the fact that GDP, which is the way that governments measure growth and the indicator they use to see if they're doing well, there are a number of efforts now to show that this is crazy, you know, partly based on the sort of thing I was saying.
Mm-hmm.
And the Genuine Progress Index is a an attempt to develop an alternative index which will look at, you know, employment, physical health, which will look at those benefits, what would be real progress for any society, any sane society, would say that, of course, it's in our public interest to keep people healthy rather than thinking that it's progress to build more hospitals or, you know. So the Genuine Progress Index is something that was started by someone named Ron Coleman, and that's also been linked up to an effort in Bhutan, you know, the little kingdom, where the king a long time ago said, we're more interested in gross national happiness than we are in gross national product. So there is quite a move underway now. The Prime Minister of the UK has just come out with a big new plan, and even that there's going to be a happiness minister, and that he's claiming now that every choice they make is going to consider their impact on human well-being. I'm a bit skeptical because he's also saying,
land is your land. This land is join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. on the BBS Radio Network. This land was made for you and me.
We teach them how to tie their shoes. They teach us how to live our lives. We teach them long division. They teach us how to bank online. Our children will always outgrow us. But for the first time in generations, they may not outlive us. Over the last 25 years, the percent of overweight children aged 6 to 11 has doubled. The percent of overweight teenagers tripled. Obesity kills. Heart disease, high blood pressure, diabetes, all are linked to obesity, a problem that could be greatly reduced just by having a place to exercise. Right now, people are working hard to put parks and playgrounds where children live, where children will use them. Finding out how you can help is as easy as tying your shoes. Log on to earthshare.org now. A public service message brought to you by EarthShare and the Ad Council.
Got questions? The library has got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
Hello, everyone. This is Basma Farhat. Welcome back to The People Speak with Helena Norberg-Hodge, co-filmmaker to the documentary The Economics of Happiness and co-founder of Local Futures. How are you, Helena? Thank you for being with us again this evening.
Thank you.
And I have some questions from some of our audience that are calling in. John in Canada would like to ask, is there any one country more guilty of spreading globalism? I've heard that the USA is the number one enslaver of third world economies.
Yes, I mean, I would say the U.S. political system, and that's been both presidents, you know, Democrats and Republicans, have pushed harder for supporting multinationals and billionaires globally. But it's really important to remember that it's not helping the American people. In fact, the American people, as we know, are suffering from this tremendously. And often the analysis thinks that, yeah, they're destroying the third world, but they're also destroying their own country. So really, they're helping to create billionaires in China and Africa and so on, but impoverishing the majority of their people in America by pushing, or, you know, and having done so since the Second World War in particular, pushing for this growth through global trade. Global trade and global finance, deregulation, that's the real enemy, the real structural enemy.
Mike in California has a question for you. You mentioned that you just returned from Japan. Would you comment on the effect of globalization in Japan? Now, Japan, Helena, is considered the third world economy. This must be devastating. How can the effects of globalization be hindered or accentuated in the situation?
Well, I don't think it's considered a third world economy. You know, Japan was one of the leading economies after the Second World War, very much once they'd been dominated by the U.S., it was working closely with the U.S. and also pursuing this path of creating multinationals, high-tech business, also destroying their farmers and smaller businesses. The effect there and in Korea in some ways is even worse than in America, in that the average person who has a job is working insanely hard. This is the trend, you know, worldwide, that those who have a job are working many more hours. You know, the average American is working about a month and a half more per year than they did in the 60s. In Japan, people now, you know, typical picture is that the father doesn't get home till 11 o'clock at night and that the children go to after school because competition, of course, starts in school. You have to be really well prepared if you want to get a job. So the children often don't get home till 9 o'clock. So there's tremendous stress and pressure, and that's having a huge toll. There's a word in Japanese for dying from overwork. People literally sort of keel over just out of exhaustion. There's also a word, hikikomori, for young people, particularly young men, who refuse to ever leave their bedroom, you know, just sort of locking themselves in their bedroom for years. And I think there are now about a million youth who do that, and it's very clearly fear of failure, either at university or in their workplace. So there are very serious signs of stress, and it's so sad when you realize that this work pressure is, you know, utterly and totally unnecessary. It's a complete function of policy.
Ellen in Pennsylvania has a question, and she asks, how does localization compete with globalism when the products and goods being sold by local markets are oftentimes more expensive to produce and sell than their competitors, the huge corporate-owned stores?
Yeah, this is a really very, very valuable question, and one that we, again, where we need economic literacy. We need to realize that whenever we go to the marketplace to pay for something, like to pay for our food, we have paid through one pocket where we paid our taxes. And so we have two pockets. One of it is the money that's left over, and the other one is what we spent on taxes. Those taxes are being used to make processed dead food, packaged, irradiated, colored, from the other side of the world, cheaper than local food. I am absolutely, and also they're being made to favor enormous monocultures, which are completely unnatural and actually not productive. We're wasting water and land on giant monocultural farms and this import and export, and that's because that's what we've been subsidizing. So I'm convinced that if people understood this, and again, that economic literacy demanded economic policy change, they would be in agreement that they would prefer to have fresh, non-chemical food at a lower price and toxic food from far away at a higher price, which is actually the natural thing. I mean, if people understood that around the world, butter from a mile away costs more than butter from 100 miles away, or actually 10,000 miles away, they would understand that there's something very funny going on here. It's, how can that be? Well, it is because we're subsidizing the trade and the multinationals and favoring this dependence on import and export. And the end result is lower quality products, more toxic products at a lower price, and high quality, non-toxic products at a higher price. So, yeah, it is about waking up to the subsidies, the taxes, and regulations, which also destroy small local businesses. And if I could just say, the regulations is a very important part of it. because tragically many small business people and small farmers end up very angry at the environmentalists and at the left because they think that it's their work that's leading to the destruction of their businesses, that they're the ones who've lobbied mm-hmm. for regulations. They don't realize that these regulations are brought in to try to control the abuses of giant businesses. But the end result is that they often end up destroying the small. If I could just add to that also that, you know, if you have a factory farm, you know, literally with thousands of chickens all crowded together, very unhealthy, completely unnatural, they need antibiotics, hormones, everything else. There's regulation to try to prevent the abuse, and you need health inspectors and so on. Now, what happens is the farmer who has 10 chickens grazing out on the green field ends up having to have the same health inspection, and it makes them go broke. We have lots and lots of examples of that in the European Union, having to have tiles in your ceiling costing thousands of dollars. It drives small producers out of business. So the whole issue of regulations is incredibly important.
One of the things that I am finding, I believe, as I watch the large corporations take the actions that they take, they seem to be rushing to and making tremendously environmentally hazardous mistakes, such as the Gulf oil spill. You know, we become so terrified of being put in a corner by other countries based on our consumption or our overconsumption that we're making rash decisions that ultimately cost us a million times more than it would have cost us just to go through the regular sources. Do you find that that's a problem, Helena?
I do. I think it's again, you know, if we understand how growth is measured by governments and working with the multinationals, and that it's at every step of the way based on longer distances, more waste, more energy. You know, the statistics about how much energy you use in America or Germany or Japan or whatever are a complete nonsense today. Because if you wanted to really know what energy you're using, you'd have to go to China and Vietnam and see that factory, you know, that made your socks and your iPhone and your, you know, and often the parts are made all over the world. We don't have an accurate analysis now because we're not looking at the global economy. People are still operating as though the economy is happening at a local or national level when it's not. So first of all, to me, it's not so much about we being fearful. It's about our governments and big business pushing us in this direction, which entails enormous waste of energy. And they are scaling up the abuse of nature, you know, whether it's the shale or the cutting off mountaintops or now gas fracking, which I hope everybody's heard of, which is, you know, pumping toxic chemicals into our drinking water to extract gas. And honestly, if we were to sit down and, again, with this economic literacy, look at what would we actually need to have adequate shelter, lighting, fuel for cooking, heating, you know, the things that people really need. How much energy would we need? What would happen if we did away with a consumer culture that is foisting gadgets on our children and fashion that changes from year to year and built-in obsolescence where these products are now made to break faster and faster? What would really happen if we did away with that as a structure, as an economy, as a government? We would see that we need vastly less energy than we're told we need to provide for our real needs. And that would include transport. It would include us being able to travel to the other side of the world. But there again, you know, people have forgotten that we used to have these wonderful ships that went between Europe and America, well, went across the world. There were thousands of them. They've all but disappeared now, and if you want to go by boat, it costs, you know, 1,000 times more than flying. And the subsidies to the airline industry, instead of subsidizing trains and ships, means that we have, again, you know, support for what is toxic and polluting and no support for the healthier modes of transport.
Mm-hmm. We have a question from Alice in New York. Could Helena give her insights on a solution for new energy sources to replace the oil consumption that seems to drive so much of the corporate led wars and bullying we see in the Middle East, South America, Africa, and elsewhere?
Well, I know that when you're living, you know, in New York City, it can seem completely, you know, unrealistic to imagine that we could get our energy from renewable sources. But I have seen, you know, working in several countries, that providing renewable energy technologies costs far less in terms of resources and far less in terms of money. But again, tragically, the big oil industry has been undermining us at every turn. Now, we already know that with wind and hydro and solar that we can manufacture a lot of energy. The approach to this would be, obviously, that you don't suddenly turn off everything that's run with coal or fossil fuels in New York. It would be a staged approach of gradually replacing the energy systems. And, you know, we should be making sure that the energy that we do have, the fossil fuels we do have, are used for the absolute real needs instead of this shipping back and forth of identical products and triple wrapping everything in plastic. I mean, people just haven't understood how ensnared we've become in what is called efficiency, but it's actually efficient for giant corporations, highly inefficient for us and for use of resources. I'd like to just add to that, this is a slightly separate point, but it's related, and that is that there are more and more studies that show that small-scale diversified farms, ideally with animals on them, animals eating waste and weeds and grazing on land where you can't grow, when you have diversified food production, you can produce vastly more. I mean, certainly twice as much, but even up to 10 times as much per unit of land and water as we do with these giant corporate monocultures. Most people believe that this big scale is necessary to feed the world, but even in New York City, the energy consumption would be dramatically reduced if we develop further the regional food economy. And it needs development, it needs support, it needs some of the subsidies in order to bring down the prices and make it available to everybody.
So what we have here now, again, now this is the most important part, solutions, regulate, tax, and subsidies, local banks, local food, farmers markets, urban gardening, collaborative efforts and collaborative community efforts. Are these the way of the future? Is this the only way that we're going to be able to sustain ourselves?
Well, I think that if, again, with an understanding of the psychology, it, for me there's an inevitability that, first of all, for human beings, for psychological well-being, they need to grow up with real live role models. It's very frightening to see the effect on young children of trying to model themselves on these images of perfection, the distances that are being created and the separation and competition is creating enormous psychological problems. And I mean, in every country now, depression, suicide, and so on are on the increase. So there is a fundamental human need for community and connection. There's also a fundamental human need for feeling a part of the natural world, feeling a part of something bigger than ourselves. And for nature herself, diversity is essential. We are on a path right now where our economic trajectory is head-on colliding with the needs of nature. That means we're basically destroying the real economy. Everything we use, from our phones to our coal to our, you know, food, everything comes from the natural world. And by pushing larger and larger distances, bigger and bigger businesses, bigger and bigger scale excavation and resource extraction, we are killing ourselves. We're killing the planet. So what localization is about is a turn towards shortening the distances, which leads to more diversified, healthier, and sustainable production. Naturally, when a farmer is selling in a farmer's market, the market, the free market, pressures them towards diversity. They can't get rid of, you know, tons and tons of straight carrots. They're going to do much better if they start also growing some herbs and some fruit. And the more diversity they grow, the better they'll do. And that's what's happening in the farmers' markets that we've helped to start. You know, you can just talk to the farmers. They used to grow two things. Now they're growing 20 things. And with that, the ecosystem starts flourishing. So we really are talking about, yes, an inevitability that we need to localize. Local is a relative term. So exactly how local, how much industrial production, which, of course, there is an efficiency, you know, when we're producing radios and rubber balls, there is a certain efficiency of scale, which there isn't with natural systems. With farming, fishery, and forestry, it's almost better, the smaller the scale and the more labor. And the interesting thing, too, with the natural systems is that when you have small-scale, diversified production, the work is very enjoyable. It's when it's part of the large monocultures it becomes drudgery. So anyway, with industrial production, obviously things are not going to be as local, but we have to understand the political necessity of insisting that businesses belong to a country, that once they go multinational, they start blackmailing countries against each other, betting, you know, basically lobbying for the lowest environmental regulations, the lowest price in labor, and they threaten governments, you know, we'll go somewhere else if you don't let us do it here, which is exactly what happened after the financial crisis. You know, the reason we've had almost no meaningful regulation now is that the banks were threatening to go elsewhere and countries were caving in, and we're sort of back on the same agenda now.
Well, you know, I have to assume that it's safe to say that you're suggesting, not only in the film but in many of your talks, the first world powers are sabotaging not only the third world economies but their own as well.
Absolutely, and I think it's really important that we understand that it's happening in the West as much as it is in the third world. And we also need to understand now that the elite in the third world is a very, very big problem. There's tremendous greed being created, you know, for this consumer culture. And so it's, again, I think with a global understanding, we have to link up globally with those people who understand, you know, that we need to protect the environment and that we all believe in a certain level of justice and equality, which doesn't, what I think is really wonderful about localization is that it doesn't have to be one size fits all, because localizing is about adapting to diversity, and it's not about a top-down government-run economy as in communism. It's a real alternative that is profoundly in harmony with ecology and psychology, with human needs and nature's needs. It's about adapting to the needs of people and nature. And I think, you know, most people would agree with that if they could, you know, maybe they don't believe it's possible, but I think maybe one of the biggest problems we have. Sorry?
I don't know that people don't think it's possible. We have incredible imaginations as human beings. I don't think they believe that it's happening, unfortunately. And that's one of the things. We have one more question I really got to get in, because this is one of our regulars here. Phil from Kansas is asking, Helena, is Helena acquainted with Dr. Muhammad Yunus, whose system of microeconomics raised Bangladesh out of poverty? In a way, it seemed to be a localization approach to banking and money.
Yes, I do know him personally, and we, you know, we were on the same radio program at one point and so on. But I have been trying to raise awareness about the fact that a lot of the microcredit schemes, including his Grameen Bank, were targeting rural populations and giving loans to women who were leaving agriculture to start producing maybe fashion clothes or something. There's a structural problem with this, because these were people who were not in debt and they're now going into debt, and it's in such a volatile, unstable global economy So I just want to warn against blindly promoting microcredit. It's in the third world. In our countries, microcredit would be fabulous. Our whole system runs on debt. We're all indebted. And we've all left the land. These are people who are quite self-reliant often, who have some chickens and cows, and leaving that in order to become dependent on them, first of all, go into debt and then become dependent on that production of less necessary things, can be a huge problem. There's also been a big problem that there has been too much interest charged, and so there's been some scandals associated with it. But I think it's more about the structural problem that right now we really should not be thinking of pulling more people into a dependence on debt. If there are people who are in rural societies who are not indebted, let's help to strengthen their productivity and their ability to support themselves. If we get a fair and just global system and, a stable global economy, then it might be different. But right under the current conditions, I want to warn against microcredit in the Grameen Bank.
I think what I'm hearing here is that, as cultures, I think that our longevity has proven itself in relation to the so-called westernized societies and worlds. And are people really better off by westernizing? And I think that's really the key. And I absolutely appreciate the fact that this film so succinctly talks about the negative response, the negative connotations of globalization, and how blindsided we are being. And I think it's interesting.
Thank you so much for saying that. It'd be great if people could go to our website. It's the same as the title of the film, theeconomicsofhappiness.org. So it's just that, theeconomicsofhappiness.org.
You also have another website, localfutures.org, if
yes,
I'm not mistaken.
Also. But
so
the Economics
please,
of Happiness one has lots of materials and other organizations they can link up to and follow up on these issues.
It's a fascinating subject. The film is fascinating. It will help you to understand why this is not a good thing. We are digging our own graves at this point. Thank you, Helena, for being with us this evening. It's a pleasure having you. We hope to call you back one day again and kind of see where the localization projects are going, and maybe you'd consider coming back.
I would definitely do so. I would love to.
Thank you. Next week's guest, Kathy Berry, PhD author of Unmaking War and Remaking Men, How Empathy can Reshape Our Politics, Our Soldiers, and Ourselves. That's March 22nd, folks, next Tuesday. Thank you for being with us tonight. It was a pleasure having all of you. And again, don't forget, the people have the power. When the people speak, they make a difference. Good night from Basma Farhat.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the sea by the relief office I saw my people, and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.